Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to the Thanksgiving edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I am well. In the interest of full disclosure, our show is pre-recorded tonight because you and I really aren't here.
That's true. We're
yes.
celebrating and
we are
enjoying
celebrating.
A little holiday.
That's exactly right.
But we didn't want to leave listeners without a holiday treat.
And I think we have a good one, actually.
Yeah.
So we've got a slightly different format to our show this evening. We have a wonderful interview with Chef Bijou Thomas, who along with Dr. Ellen Lim has a new book from Velo Press called The Feed Zone Cookbook. Chef Thomas has a charmed life. He has regular dinner parties in Boulder at which he and Alan gather with their dear friends like the Finneys.
The Davis Finneys.
The Hamstons.
The Andy Hamstons.
You know, just the usual riffraff of cycling. And make these fabulous meals. And then he makes all the guests wash the dishes. No, I don't know that that's true. I just kind of made that up. But anyway, he's going to talk to us about this book. And he is chef to the stars of cycling. It's just very cool.
Food is one of the better components of cycling and one of the better, fringe benefits.
Yes.
Being able to...
As in ride to eat.
That's exactly right.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and he's got... His recipes are clean and simple, and you don't need tons of ingredients. And I'm telling you, this is an awesome book. It even makes me want to cook, and I don't like cooking.
Wow.
Yeah. We also have another fabulous story from Maynard Hirshon this evening, and it's sort of a holiday story. I love this story. It's one of Brian's favorites. It will make you love your bike shop and your bike shop owner. Whoever your local bike shop is, go in and pat him on the back.
Because,
or her. That's a good point. Because I'll tell you, this is a fabulous story. It is not a real story. Maynard did not actually know somebody have this happen to a bike shop owner he knows.
It's fictional.
It is fictional.
Yeah.
Thank you. That sort of describes it. It's fictional, but it is just a charming story nonetheless.
All right. And then in the second half, we're going to do a little encore of an interview that I particularly enjoyed. You did this a few months back over at the late Joseph Beth Booksellers here in down the street from the station.
In Legacy Village.
Yep. And there was a gentleman in town who had just released a book at that time, I think.
Right. Called The Lost Cyclist.
The Lost Cyclist. David V. Herlihy.
Correct.
Yep. So we're going to take a second listen to that just in the interest of kind of having a little downtime and a little reflection on the Thanksgiving weekend.
Right. And I have a cute little story to read.
Why don't you go ahead and do that now? And then we'll get on to Chef Bijou.
Okay. On Biking, a Winter Ode from a Casual Cyclist. This is by Susan Myers, who was a guest columnist for Boston.com. Biking is not my religion. It's not my commute. It's not my response to global warming. Not how I save money. Not my get fit strategy. Biking is cool, but no one who sees me on a bike thinks, hey, cool. They did think, hey, get back in the bike lane. Hey, lady, good thing you're wearing that helmet. You're not the most skilled cyclist I've ever seen. I'm not. I know I'm not. But I'm on my bike anyway, just like a lot of other not the most skilled cyclists. And I'm out here because it's fun. I never regret a ride. Nope, the mystery is why I don't ride more often. Let's round up the usual discouragements at this time of year. Traffic, of course, but that's a problem year-round. Foul weather, not having enough time to bike. There's nowhere good to ride around here anyway. But these are just excuses. We've got bike paths and bike lanes and 10 miles out of town, we have beautiful rolling hills. There are sweaters, there are gloves. 30 minutes is enough time for a short ride. Lastly, there are satisfying places to ride in and around Boston if you know where to go. Still, as the cold weather closes in, I have to talk myself onto my bike. My husband thinks I'm nuts, since he practically wakes up in the morning with both feet pedaling. His bike obsession is the bright twin to my own trepidation, and we both know it. I realized just this week that anything with the word bike in it stops him in his tracks. Bike tour, bike gear, bike ride for charity. I'll bet if you put the word bicycle in front of any word in the English language, I said, in front of any noun or verb, that thing would sound instantly interesting to you, wouldn't it? Like what, he said. Like, say, bicycle badminton, bicycle bartending, bicycle diplomacy, bicycle dentistry, bicycle potatoes. Oh, you're right, he agreed. For fun, we thought up a few more. Bike lint, bike barbecue, bicycle hospital, bike beard, bicycle lawnmower. Later that same evening, I paused as I passed the open bathroom door. My husband was in there plunging our ever uncooperative, low-flow toilet. If only there were some way to combine biking and toilet plunging, I said in a dreamy voice, as if I were reading his mind, then maybe all this plunging wouldn't be so terrible. Making fun of someone who is plunging a toilet isn't so nice. Throwing your head back and laughing while plunging a toilet is also ill-advised. Happy to say that my husband and I have a long history of laughing together at whatever awfulness comes at us, and so that's what we did. We laughed. Laughter, it's a kind of glue. It can preserve, even fortify, a relationship. I think my relationship with my bike needs more laughter.
Nice.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah.
I just thought that was a great story. I like the plunging. I thought that that was very clever. So, yes.
And she's right. Everything is better with a bike. There's almost nothing that can't be improved with the addition of a bicycle.
I could think a couple of things.
Well, don't think too hard.
Okay, I'll try not to. All right. So, hello, Chef Bijou. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Hello, Diane. Thank you. It's wonderful. Thank you.
I'm excited because I have a copy of the Feed Zone cookbook, and you actually are inspiring a non-cook to cook.
Ah, well, that's good. You know what? I've been hearing that from a lot of people, so we're succeeding with that.
Yes, I think you are, too. Well, when you hear of somebody like Levi Leipheimer cooking for himself, and it's like, really? He's cooking? He can cook. I can cook. You know? So,
yeah.
I'd like to get a little bit of background on you and how you came to develop your thinking about food as it relates to cycling.
Sure. I grew up here in Colorado, so I grew up in Denver, and now I'm living up in Boulder, and I grew up racing bikes back in the 80s. So, I mean, if you follow cycling at all, 80s were kind of, you know, the very fertile starting days of pro cycling in the U.S., and I was kind of a little kid growing up during that era and seeing all these amazing athletes and all this talent all around me, and it just so happened, I grew up in a huge family where everybody loves to cook, so it was really wasn't an option. All of us cooked. So at some point, I got to kind of join both things down the road here.
In the 80s, when you were cycling, were you cycling on a team?
Yeah. I grew up as I started racing as juniors, I think 85 maybe, when I was 15 or 16, 85, 86. I was on a junior team here in Denver, and oddly enough, there's a handful of other people that kind of passed through the same era. Jonathan Vodders was on another team. I think JV's 2 years younger than me.
Okay.
He was on another team here, and then Robin Thurston, who's still one of my good friends, a guy who started Map My Ride, he and I were juniors on the same team at the same time. So, yeah, there's a handful of us all grew up here at the same time that are all kind of at some point or someplace still in the industry now.
You say that you're sort of a self-taught chef.
Yes.
I have to say the book is beautiful. Really, really beautiful. And when, of course, I know that food stylists take these wonderful pictures, but there are a lot of things in this book that the average athlete, especially cyclists, are going to find really tempting to try by themselves. They're not hard recipes. So how did you begin to develop some of these ideas about cooking and
sure.
what would work for a cyclist?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And back to the first thing you said about the food stylist, when Alan and I started writing and thinking about the book, one of the original thoughts was the food had to be honest and it had to be exactly what we said it was. So, and this is one of the book is out from Velo Press, who puts out Velo News and puts out, you know, a ton of other wonderful cycling, and the parent publisher puts out all these triathlon and running stuff. This is one of the few books they've done that are, every page is a big, beautiful color photograph. And if you look at most food magazines or books, the things that you see in food publications are typically very heavily handed or handled. And one of the things that was important to us was that the food look exactly the way it would look if a normal person at home followed our instructions and made it. So the food in the book is exactly what the recipe says, and it was all made out of my tiny kitchen on the day of the photo shoot. So one of my good friends and I cooked every single dish. I had two saute pans. I don't think I had a blender. So we had two just nonstick saute pans, had a rice cooker, and an electric stove. Everything was cooked with that. The final photographs are exactly what the ingredients say it is. There's no mystery ingredients. It was all shot within maybe 1 to 2 minutes after it was cooked. So very, very little handling.
So how long did it take to actually assemble all of these dishes?
We did the entire photo shoot in 4 days. We did about 30 to 40 dishes a day.
Because it's 150 recipes.
Yeah, 150 recipes that finished up in the book. And we started with, I think, around 300, which we pared down. And then we picked about 150, 160, and then from that, to keep it a nice, clean number, 150 dishes at the book. We did about 30 to 40 dishes a day that we were cooking. We were cooking and then running downstairs to take all the photographs. And then we were, as soon as the photographs were being done, I was already on to the next dish. And so I had to do all of the dishes, plus if there was an accompaniment or a sauce or something, all that was done, 30 to 40 dishes a day.
You know, you make it sound so simple, and it's one of the things that I really like about the book, that everything, I always find everything so daunting. It's like I never seem to have the ingredients, and I, you know, you have to go shopping and all of that. Talk to us a little bit about ingredients and the quality of the ingredients.
That's a great point. I think a lot of people who maybe don't cook, and in particular my audience who are athletes, who cooking, even though food is a huge and integral part of their daily life and their performance and their results, it's one of the few things we really don't want to think about too much. So my take on it is keep it as simple as possible. And to that end, everything needs to be the freshest possible thing you can get. And that doesn't mean everything always has to be organic or it has to come from the most expensive store. It just means get, you know, whole ingredients. I mean, get real products. Really don't buy anything that finishes in the box. Like if it goes in a microwave and you start it and you end up with a meal, you probably don't need to eat that. And likewise, if it comes in a cardboard box, other than cereal, which we go through tons of, nothing should ever come in a box. And a lot of times when I'm working with newer guys, young guys that are just getting into pro cycling or they're just starting their pro careers, we talk a lot about how they should shop. And the way to shop is you just work the perimeter of the store. You first walk in, you get all your produce, you go down to dairy, you get whatever you need to get, you get your meat, you get your proteins, you get some bread if you need, and you walk out the door. You very, very seldom need to go into the middle of the store except for when you need aluminum foil or olive oil.
Are you saying that all grocery stores are set up like that pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much every store, if you go and look, all the fresh stuff is on the perimeter of the store. And I can walk into a store, buy everything I need for 10 guys, and be out of the store in less than like 15 minutes. So all I do is get a cart, just go around the perimeter of it, hit all the produce, keep going, hit the dairy, hit the meats, keep going, get some, you know, last-minute things and out the store. Unless you're shopping for diapers or detergents or, you know, other things, you never really need to go to the middle aisles.
And that's
where people
cool.
get into trouble, is you obviously see cookies, you see, you know, all this stuff in jars and bottles and stuff that looks pretty but really is, you know, mostly crap.
I got
yeah.
I got what you're saying. Interesting. So the book, the Feed Zone Cookbook, goes from breakfast through dessert.
Yes.
And one of the things that I really liked, it was something that you said in here about a special sports drink.
Yes, that would be Alan's secret drink mix. That's Dr. Alan Lim's formulation for one of the best and most sought-after hydration drinks that are out there. And Alan's, the name secret, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, and it's, you know, it's kind of an inside joke between all of us that kind of have been around him for a while. But Alan's been making this drink mix that has a ridiculously strong following. And a lot of the big-name athletes and teams have been using it for quite a few years now, whether at the Tour de France or local races. But it's always been kind of an unbranded product because they probably have a sponsor or whatever the deal is. But this is the stuff that works. And we've always just called it Secret Drink Mix, and that's what that's all about. And now, actually, you can buy it. You go to secretdrinkmix.com, and you can buy the stuff. There's a quick plug. You put in my name, you get a discount.
And that's fine. And let's remind our listeners that we're speaking with Chef Bijou, who is the co-author of the Feed Zone Cookbook, along with Dr. Alan Lim, who is evidently somewhere in the background helping to cook dinner. So how do you feel about organic foods? I know you want things fresh. How do you feel about the whole idea of organic versus non-organic?
Personally, as a chef and as a consumer, I think organic is nice. It sounds nice. But I think it's less important than, you know, within your own budget and the own reality of your own life, getting the freshest thing possible. A lot of times, and most people don't realize it, but just because something says organic, if it's traveling from the opposite end of the planet to get here, if you're thinking just in terms of overall waste and energy being burned to get it here, it almost seems like, you know, what are you gaining by that in the grand scheme of things? But what we've learned is you don't always get the option of organic for everything. The simplest thing I can tell people is get the freshest thing possible. Where organic is key is where things that are heavily sprayed with pesticides or you know, chemicals, such as strawberries or lettuces, those are exposed to a lot of chemicals if they're coming from conventional farms. So those, when you get organic, you're basically taking out that possibility that you're going to consume, you know, any extra chemicals and crap that you don't really need in your system.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it comes down to getting the best and freshest thing that you personally can afford and handle and is available wherever it is you live.
Let's get back to the book for a second. And do you have any special recipes that you find really interesting that people wouldn't think of? You have something called the waffle ride sandwich, for example.
Well, the waffle ride sandwich, and this, you know, that's an interesting one. It comes, if you look at a lot of the European pro cyclists from the 80s, before the days, or, you know, up to the 80s, you know, all the way through, I think Power Bar kind of popped out of nowhere in 85, 86.
Right.
Up until then, you know, this is what the guys ate at the races. You took little dinner rolls and stuffed them with some cheese and some jam and maybe got a piece of prosciutto or, you know, ham or something in there. And then if you're a Belgian rider or some of the French riders, you could get waffles. And you would put all the stuff in the waffles because the little squares would keep all the, you know, gooey, delicious goodness from dripping out of the sandwich during a 4 or 5 hour ride. So we kind of wanted to just do an homage to that and the recipe in the book, I believe, it's a brown rice that we make. And we do these rice pancakes that are essentially it's rice, it's cooked rice, a couple of bananas, a few eggs, and a little bit of milk. It goes into a blender, and that's everything. That's all your ingredients. You make pancakes with it. You make waffles. You can, you know, make muffins, whatever. But it's essentially some cooked rice and some bananas.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really, really interesting is how simple and how few ingredients are really used, and yet you are feeding athletes who consume huge numbers of calories every day.
Oh, absolutely. I think if you look at major stage races, you know, come towards the second half of the race, these guys are burning through, 7,000 to 9,000 calories a day, and you can't possibly get all that back in just by having a big breakfast.
Right.
That's where all the, you know, the amazing liquids and the hydrations and all the gels and the magic food comes into play. But still, at the end of the day, we're dealing with human beings and not robots, and these guys need real food. So my job as a cook turns into making the most delicious food in the right combinations so the guys are eating the volumes they need. Just because something is really good or looks good, if you don't eat it, it doesn't do you any good. Or if it, you know, if it sounded really good coming from your coach or your nutritionist or you read about it, if it sounds awesome but you don't want to eat it, then you know, it's kind of, you know, it's not doing any good.
You and I had a conversation through email about the idea of gluten-free and vegetarian. I know some of the athletes in the past couple of years have thought about these and actually put them into practice, being eaters of vegan eaters or vegetarian eaters. And there's a lot of vegan and vegetarian options in the book. How is that working out? And are people sticking with these kinds of choices?
I think I know you're speaking about the vegan diet, and a lot of that in the last season, I think probably the most visible person we were hearing about was Dave Zabriskie. And Dave's one of these guys, you could put him on a diet of cardboard, and he would probably do okay. So that doesn't really relate to normal people. Dave's a ridiculously talented, ridiculously dedicated, strong athlete. But it was really cool seeing him do that diet because, you know, here's somebody at that level of the game who's willing to see what it does for him personally. And he still had a phenomenal season. I mean, he went 100% vegan last year. And this year, you know, I think he's changing it up a little bit too. And we'll wait to see what he's up to when the season starts. But I hear he's got some new stuff in the works this season.
Well, he makes a heck of a chamois cream. I hope you know that.
Yeah, he does make a heck of a chamois cream. And,
it's not edible, though.
He's a spokesman for it, too. So he's a good dude in all aspects of telling a good story.
Yeah.
To your question about the gluten-free, we've had a lot of athletes and a lot of people, even in the general public, going gluten-free and this, that, and the other thing. And Alan will be the first one to tell you, there's really never been any published studies on the real effects of a gluten-free diet on non-celiacs. So what we've discovered more than anything is when people go on a strict diet, whether it's I'm going to be gluten-free, I'm going to be, what is the paleo diet, I'm only going to eat meat, or I'm only going to eat red food, or whatever it is, as soon as you put yourself in the mentality that I'm going to do this, you become much more aware of what you're actually eating. And you're making more conscious choices and putting things into your body that you're much more aware of. And that's probably the bigger result. Or that's probably where you're seeing the bigger results. It's just the actual fact that you're being more conscious of what you're eating.
That's very true. So I have been on a gluten-free diet for 6 months now. And the differences I was thinking I was going to get, I didn't get. But what it really did was exactly what you said, made me a lot more conscious of what I put in my mouth and how I eat and when I eat. And that, I think, unto itself makes you responsible for your own diet.
That's exactly it. And actually, to speak to your anti-inflammatory diet, you know, in simple terms, because I get asked the same question a lot, what that means is, you know, if you drink a bunch of beer before you go to sleep, or you eat a bunch of spaghetti before you go to sleep at night, and in my case, I will wake up, my face feels puffy, you know, at night my body temperature's off, I don't sleep well, I usually have to open all the windows, keep the blankets off, and that pretty much directly, in my case, is a response to when I have too much wheat or bread or wheat gluten or beer or anything before I go to sleep.
Right.
And that has been the biggest thing that we hear from people is as soon as they eliminate wheat gluten, whether it's bread or pasta or beer, they sleep better. And a few years ago, I did a training camp with some riders. Half of the riders we had on a regular diet and the other half we had on a gluten-free diet, and the same thing. They're recovering instantly, go do a 4 or 5 hour ride, instantly feeling better, sleeping better, not feeling normally as worn out. So if they feel it and if they're performing accordingly, then there is some truth to it. That's pretty much been my experience with a gluten-free diet.
And there are other things that I have experienced, but I would say that being conscious of what I eat, and I lost a lot of weight too, so that didn't hurt.
Right.
More importantly, the Feed Zone Cookbook. So how long has it been out?
I think it just started shipping like a week ago. So it, I think it first started coming out for reviews sometime in October, and it just started shipping. So it should be at bookstores and whatnot right about now. It just started shipping.
Well, I have my copy, and I really like it a lot. I like that it's, I'll tell you, it's the simplicity that that gets me, that, you know, okay, so I'm just opening it to a page, roasted beets and greens, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ingredients.
Absolutely.
I mean, how hard is that?
And actually, I made that yesterday. So the dressing, I don't have the book in front of me, but I think it's just a simple Dijon vinaigrette.
Nice.
A little bit of Dijon, some olive oil, and some lemon juice, some salt, some cooked beets, put it on some greens, put it on some breads. We go through a lot of beets, and turns out most all the riders I work with, everybody loves beets. Why not? It's cheap. It's good for you. We eat tons of beets.
I like beets. I only have one friend who wouldn't touch a beet if it's the last food on earth, but that's his problem.
You know why it is? Probably because he's probably thinking of the cans, you know, the beets we all grew up with over the holidays that just tasted like tin can and had a weird texture and were, you know, watery.
You are probably right. Well, you know what? I think the book is awesome. I think that your ideas are awesome, and I am hoping that someday I'll get to meet you in person and enjoy a meal with you. That would be fun.
Oh, that would be lovely. Yeah.
Yeah.
We do regular dinners here back home in Colorado, so invite yourself over.
I would like to do that. Well, Chef, thank you so much for spending time with us this evening. The Feed Zone Cookbook, Chef Bijou Thomas and Dr. Alan Lim, and we'll catch up with you again sometime.
Great. Thank you, Diane. This was great.
Thank you. Have a nice night. Enjoy your dinner.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Chef Bijou Thomas joined us from Boulder, Colorado, where he was getting ready to prepare what I'm sure is going to be a fabulous meal.
Gourmet.
Yes.
Unlike what I'll probably have for dinner.
Well, you open up that cookbook and pick something out.
I'm telling you, it's a beautiful book. I love it.
I was peeking over the desk here at it, and really nice stuff. Simple, fresh.
There's some very interesting things in the front of the book explaining about power and about going to bed hungry or not. There's some interesting things that really weren't in the chef's realm, more in Dr. Lim's realm.
Right.
But I think that the whole book really holds together well, and the recipes are really simple. I mean, if I can't do this stuff, I need to be like banned from the kitchen forever. You know, just
well,
just
and I've got a, I don't like sports drinks either, but I've got to check out this
secretdrink.com.
Secret whatever, yeah.
I think
yeah,
that's
I got to see if that's any good or not.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
It'll probably be Kool-Aid. I'm kidding.
I don't know what it is, but
me neither.
If I like it, then it's probably pretty good because I'm not a big fan. So
yeah,
we'll
I'm not
happens.
A big fan of a lot of those things either.
All right.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying this pre-recorded Thanksgiving edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a short break. We'll have more right after this.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
How's that cooked?
How do you change the ringtone?
How much does this cost?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life, except...
Any questions?
No.
At the doctor's office. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
We have up next something that I've been looking forward to. I always like when this gentleman joins us on the show. And so we're getting ready to welcome him back with another one of his great stories.
Yes. One of my very good friends, personally, he is one of my friends. His name is Maynard Hirshhorn. You've heard from him before. He has what we have both decided is a good story for these upcoming holidays. So we'll bring Maynard back. Maynard, it's so nice to talk to you. As always, thanks for joining us this evening.
Great to be here, Diane.
And it's wonderful to talk to you again. I'm very excited. I know the story you're going to tell this evening, and it's a great story that every cyclist, every bike shop owner, everybody in the industry will be able to relate to, and it's a feel-good story. So are you ready?
I am.
Okay.
Thanks, Diane. This is called Nice Wheels. Bob turned the sign to closed and clicked off the outside light. He went back to the bench and the stand and the half-trued wheel. Last one out of there as usual, he thought, turning the wheel a quarter turn each way, not yet touching it with the tool. He liked working after closing without noise or distractions or people waiting for their stuff. He liked knowing he could think about whatever he wanted to and could take his time with the work, no clock ticking. He heard tapping at the door, saw it was Eric, and motioned him to come in. "Not locked," he mouthed, nodding and making door-opening movements. Eric came in looking puzzled. He had a Campin YOLO box tucked under his arm. Hubs, maybe. "I was rooting around in the dumpster for an old rim to stretch a saw up on, and look what I found," Eric said. And handed Bob a Chorus hub set, 9-speed, 32H scrawled on the top in black marker, Bob's writing, and one of Bob's price tags stuck on the end. Eric shook his head, wearily waved goodnight, and left. Unwilling to believe what he saw, Bob stared at the box. He looked up at the shelf where the hubs should have been, and by golly, they weren't there. No, until a moment ago, they were in the dumpster. "Only someone working for me would leave this box in the dumpster after sneaking it out of the store. Anyone else would have taken these hubs right home. An employee might leave them out there, then come back after closing, after midnight maybe, and grab them when no one would see. If someone found them out there, it could be an accident. Why, they must have fallen into the wastebasket by mistake and ended up in the dumpster with the rest of the junk. Sure, lucky you found them." "Geez," Bob said out loud, "someone's taken stuff from the shop. Whoever did this wouldn't leave that box out there longer than they had to," he thought. "Must have been someone who worked today." Imagining one of his guys stealing, having to play detective and figure out who it was, made Bob tired. "I don't want to do this," he thought. "I sell the guys stuff 10% over cost. If they can't pay now, they pay little by little out of their checks. If they need to borrow something of mine, they know they just have to ask. If they need my help, whatever it is, they just have to ask. Especially if they're riding their bikes a lot, riding every day or training and racing. I'll do about anything to help." Still, here was serious evidence that one of his guys was stealing. Bob opened the box and took out the rear hub. He turned the axle and felt the grease-slowed smoothness of the bearings, spun the cassette body, and listened to the Paul's ratchet inside. He pulled his Sutherland's manual down from the shelf above the bench and leafed through it, found the pages he wanted, and did some arithmetic in pencil inside the lid of the Campy box. He bent down to boxes under the bench and counted out butted stainless spokes in three links, dunked the threaded ends into a bottle of spoke prep. He tamped the wet ends on a rag and spread the spokes out on the bench to dry. He scooped a handful of spoke nipples out of another box, found two 32-hole Mavic Aero clincher rims, and unwrapped them, laying them gently on the bench. He laced spokes onto both of the Campy hubs, threaded the spokes into the holes in the rims, and screwed on the nipples a few turns. Once, while he was mindlessly starting nipples onto spokes, he found himself wondering who the hell had taken the hubs. He made himself stop thinking like that. "Stop, Bob," and went on building the wheels. He took the customer's wheel out of the stand and hung it on a hook. He chucked the newly laced front wheel into the stand and took his time making it fine, tight, and true. He took it out of the stand and squeezed the spokes together. He put the wheel on the floor to stress it out, then put it back in the stand and touched it up, just right. He got a Velox cotton rim strip and a Phillips screwdriver. He put the Phillips through the valve hole in a tape and the valve hole in the rim, then stretched the tape around the rim tight and straight. He dusted the rim strip with talc, found two lightweight tubes and two light folding road clinchers. He sprinkled talc on the tube, put one of the tubes and one of the tires on the rim. He put in 40 pounds with a floor pump, checked the bead, and ran it up to 100. He built the rear wheel in the same methodical way, installed the other rim strip, tube, and tire, and put in 110 pounds per square inch. He found a 1223 Campy cog set, lightly greased the cassette body, slipped the cogs and spacers on, and tightened the lock nut. Nice wheels, he said, and they were nice wheels. He chucked the customer wheel back in the stand so he'd remember to work on it first thing. He turned off the fluorescence above the shop and rechecked that the back door was locked. He got his jacket and tidied up the bench, turned out lights, turned on other lights, walked to the front door and set the alarm. Carrying the fine new wheels out with him, he turned to lock the door within the seconds the alarm allowed. He peered through the glass, past the Power Bar sticker and the Oakley sticker and the GT sticker, and saw that all was just as it should be. As he passed the dumpster on the way to his old truck, he lifted the lid and gently put the wheels inside. As he lowered the lid, glare from a streetlight glinted off one of the hubs. Nice wheels, he thought. And they were nice wheels.
That story, for the listeners who just heard that story, that was Maynard Hirshhorn telling the story of these wheels. It is a fabulous story. Any bike shop owner can relate to that story and go, oh, if I only I could be that bike shop owner, you know, to have that kind of sense of oneself to take the hubs, make a perfect pair of wheels and set them back in the dumpster and go home and feel like that was the right thing to do. What a cool story, Maynard.
It was better than the right thing to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It was the only thing to do to make it right in your own mind. That was amazing.
Thanks, Ryan.
I loved it. You know, I am glad you are writing again. Like, yeah. Yes, I mean, writing a lot, I hope.
At least two stories a month.
Yes.
And sometimes three.
And so how can people read your news stories?
They can log on to thebicyclepaper.com.
Okay.
And they can read my latest column, and they can read archive columns, I think, back several years.
Awesome. Just awesome.
On that site.
So it's really nice to be able to have the kinds of stories you've read for us the last couple of times you've been on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It feels right for me to come on and read every once in a while.
I think it's great. And we enjoy having you. So I hope you have lots of good stuff for your Thanksgiving, this Thanksgiving. And I hope you take us up on the offer to come east. I mean, you know, we will throw Maynard a party. We would love
That'd be wonderful.
And ride with you, too.
Super.
All right. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Good night, Diane.
Good night, Maynard. Greg. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying this pre-recorded Thanksgiving edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. That was, of course, Maynard Hirshhorn with a great story. Up next, we will have an encore of an interview that Diane conducted with author David V. Herlihy when he was in town several months back to talk about his then new book, The Lost Cyclist.
Thank you for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're sitting at Joseph Beth after your talk this evening. I saw a lot of my friends and customers. We'll talk about your new book, The Lost Cyclist, in a moment. Where do you currently reside when you're not on the road traveling like this?
I live in Boston in the Fenway District.
And have you lived there most of your adult life?
I'd say about my last 15 or 20 years. Okay. I have been there.
Okay. And you do still ride a bicycle?
I do indeed. I have a folding bicycle that I use to get around the city.
Okay, and you didn't bring it with you?
No, it's too complicated to bring it to it when you fly, I think.
So your first book, which was the history, really, of the bicycle, documented the bicycle pretty much from its inception to current-day standards. What got you so interested in the machine and the sport of cycling?
Well, I've always had always enjoyed cycling since I was a kid. I spent some of my adolescent years in Europe, in Italy and France.
Oh, lucky you.
Yes. So, where cycling, of course, is a big deal. And so I was definitely drawn into the racing bikes. And so that was kind of my initial interest in cycling, lightweight roadsters, racing bikes. And then I got kind of drawn into the history. I started to ride in the mid-1980s for Bicycling Guide. And the editor had an interest in derailleurs and asked if I could do some research over in Europe about the origins. So I did, and that was a lot of fun. I met several people whose fathers were involved in developing the first derailleurs in the 20s and 30s and that sort of thing.
As in Campagnolo?
I did meet the...
Valentino?
Valentino,
yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the gentlemen I met in the course of the research.
So who made the first derailleur?
Man, it's a little tricky to say. I mean, there were definitely some very rudimentary systems developed in Great Britain as early as the 1890s. I think generally you'd have to credit the French, really.
Like Simplex?
Before Simplex, you had Cyclo for cyclotourists.
Oh.
And that was another family that owned that, the son of the founder I got to interview. Yeah, they really were ahead of the curve on derailleurs. Tourists were. Simplex was really more for racers, and it kind of came later.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that was that really got me interested in history. But then I kind of started going back further because at one point, while I was researching the derailleur history, I spoke with a French bicycle historian named Jacques Serret, and he immediately said to me, oh, you know, the derailleurs, that's really not very interesting. When he found out that I was from Boston, he pulled out his book and he showed me this photo from 1869, and it showed a gentleman named Pierre Lallemand sitting on top of what we now call a bone shaker. That
right.
is one of the original
types. The big high wheeler kind of.
Yeah, well, it's not a huge high wheel, but it had wooden wheels.
Okay.
And it weighed about 80 pounds. So this really was the basic bicycle, the first bicycles on the market. And
so is he credited with?
Well, it turned out, I mean, as Sarai explained to me, this fellow had the first patent, you know, defining this basic bicycle. However, it was taken out in the United States in the year 1866, and he was not generally recognized in France as the inventor of this idea. And so I was very intrigued when I found out that this gentleman was buried in Boston, where I live.
Right.
As soon as I got back, I first thing I had to do was try to figure out where he was buried, and after some research, I did find the tombstone, and I was quite surprised to see what looked like a fairly modern tombstone, when considering the fellow died in 1891.
So what did it look like?
It looked like a pretty nice marble tombstone that somebody had erected years later.
Oh, I see. So somebody who knew who he was,
yeah.
And then they sort of this tribute to him.
Right.
Okay.
But then I started to think, you know, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe whoever put this here was aware, you know, of his role in the bicycle and thought this was a proper tribute. And so I wanted to find out who this person was. You
did
know?
You?
Well, I did. Yeah, I found the record. I went to the cemetery office, and they looked back and they discovered it was a woman who had placed it there in, I think, around 78 or thereabouts. So, you know, over 80 years after his death.
And what was her interest?
Well, that's what I didn't know. So
okay.
I had to track her down, and it wasn't easy. I think I think she was living in Shaker Heights at one point,
oh.
So, of all places. So I finally did get a hold of her. And she told me that her maiden name was Lallemand, and that there was some family history about how he had been cheated out of recognition, and she felt that this was something she had to do, and she had never even seen it. She had never been to Boston.
Wow.
So I took a photo and sent it to her.
Oh, that was nice.
And then I tried to find out what she knew about the family history, and unfortunately she didn't know a lot, other than, you know, they had the common name, and evidently there had to be some connection.
Right. How many Lalamones are there?
Well, we just never figured out really what the connection was. But that was intriguing enough to get me started into researching bike history.
And so you published the bicycle history first, mm-hmm. and then somewhere along the line, this idea for this new book came along.
For Lance, yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, about 12 years ago, I had the idea of writing a book on Lance, so I actually approached a publisher with the idea, and she advised me to write a general history first. So I took her advice, and I kind of put Lance on the back burner for a while and wrote my general history. And I really didn't get back to Lance until that book came out. So around 2005 is when I plunged into it. But in the meantime, I mean, I think in some ways it was a good thing that there was that delay, because there were so many more internet-based resources available when I started the real research in 2005 than there had been earlier. And because Lenz was someone who had been almost entirely forgotten, so there'd really been nothing written about him since shortly after he disappeared, so for over a century, all I really had to go on at first were his own published accounts in Outing Magazine, which were helpful but not enough really for a book. But then I started to discover other things, like I tracked down a couple of major collections of Lenz photographs, almost all of them unpublished.
And many of them are in the book.
And many of them are in the book. Yeah. Thanks. Fortunately, the two gentlemen who own these photos made them available to me. I'm very kind about that. And I found other information here and there, tracking down descendants of certain key figures. For example, the granddaughter, the missionary who hosted the other fellow, Sock Leben, she came up with some very interesting letters written by her grandmother at the time that he was a
house guest. Is all stuff you would never have been, or it would have taken you forever to find.
I tell people, and I think this is true, that even 10 years ago, you would not have been able to write a book this detailed about Frank Lenz without having those resources available. There were other instances, you know, Google Books, et cetera, where I learned certain details that just never would have turned up without that tool. Yeah.
It's interesting. So how did you actually come to know about Frank Lenz? Evidently he was from Pittsburgh.
Right. Well, you know, I just reading late 19th century cycling literature, as I was doing from my first book, I would often come across his name. He really was a celebrity even before he left on his world tour, because he had done a number of long-distance rides in the United States on his high-wheeler with his best buddy, Charles Petticord. But, of course, once he started on his world tour, he was a national celebrity. And when he disappeared 2 years into the trip in 1894 in Turkey, he became an international celebrity. So right. I knew he was an interesting character, you know, who really had in some ways helped to introduce the American public to the new type of bicycle. Because when Lenz starts on his world tour, he's riding what was called a safety bicycle, which is essentially the modern prototype. And in fact, he even used inflatable tires, which had just come out. So it was very bold on his part because they hadn't really been tested. So Lenz really played a role, I think, in sparking the great bicycle boom, because when he left in 1892, although there were growing numbers of people starting to ride these bikes because they were much more, shall we say, user-friendly than the old high-wheeler.
Right.
You know, it was called a safety because you wouldn't, if you fell from one, you wouldn't fall as far as you would on the old bike. So it was a period in the early 1890s when there was growing interest in cycling. You see women taking it up for the first time on these new style bikes. And yet, it really wasn't the boom until a couple years later, while Frank was still en route around the world. So, you know, I realized he was an interesting pioneer, really, a promoter of this new style bike. And I felt that his story had really been lost, because although he was quite a celebrity in his own time, he had been very quickly forgotten, and almost nothing was written about him.
Yeah, he didn't become a Lindbergh, that's for sure.
No.
Or an Amelia Earhart.
No.
So, but it's the same kind of story in a way.
I think it kind of is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, he is testing a new vehicle, which was kind of the purpose, at least ostensibly, for these right. other journeys.
Right. Who made that bike?
It was made by the Overman Wheel Company, a Victor Model C, I believe. That was in Chicopee Falls, Massachusetts. Uh-huh. He actually visited the factory to go over the details with the manufacturer.
Yeah, there's some interesting photographs in the book of things like panniers that were attached to
yes.
the bike, evidently. And there's even a picture for the people in Northeast Ohio of somebody named McLaren and Petticord and Lentz. And they were riding through Cleveland's Wade Park, 4th
that's
of
right.
July, 1890, which, you know, we all, that's part of what's, it's on what we call Martin Luther King now.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's all, that was all Rockefeller land at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, interesting. Very interesting. There was another trip going on at the same time that Frank Lentz was going around the country, going around the world. Two other riders were going in the opposite direction,
that's right.
evidently.
Right, and I don't believe that Frank knew of these other two. Their names were Thomas Allen Jr. and William Sockleben, or Sockleben. And these two were interesting characters. They were both seniors at Washington College, now Washington University in St. Louis in
right.
1890. And they were not cyclists, but that was the year the safety invaded campus, and they took it up and they decided after graduating that they'd head over to Liverpool and buy a pair of safeties and just tool around in them.
Interesting.
And have some fun and while figuring out what they wanted to do themselves. And they enjoyed their summer so much that they decided they'd just continue around the world. And
did they make it around the world?
They did.
Unlike Franklin's.
That's right. Although it took them four pairs of bicycles to do it, they they did get around the world. And in fact, They weren't so well known to the American public for most of that journey because they had started in England and they weren't sponsored the way Frank was. But when they arrived on the West Coast, and they still had to cross the U.S., but they became celebrities when the press discovered them at that point. That was early 1893. You know, they marveled about how they'd ridden across the Gobi Desert. And they actually almost met Frank Lentz before they left China because Frank, of course, was working his way the opposite way. He had just started, but he had crossed the United States. So he was actually on his way to China when they were still there. And they almost intersected because when Ellen and Sockleben got to Shanghai waiting for their steamer, they had rumors that another round-the-world cyclist was going to pass through. So they dawdled hoping to meet Frank, but then he got delayed, and they were in a hurry. So they missed each other by about 10 days.
How would they have found out that there was another cyclist? What was where? How was the grapevine in those days?
You know, the Audi magazine, it had been announced. So the missionaries were probably getting wind of it. They would often visit missionaries. So the news did get around. You did have cables, so I suspect it was probably learned up from a diplomat or a missionary.
Right. Well, there was some politics that seemed to play a big role in what disappeared Frank Lentz. It was a political issue?
Oh, it was. Well, because when Frank disappeared, when news of Frank's disappearance sunk in, really, back home, that was in the fall of 1894. At that same time, Americans were receiving reports of massacres of Armenians in that same region that where Lentz had been. So there was a lot of concern that maybe Frank had stumbled into a massacre and been killed simply because he was a Christian. And so it did become kind of a hot potato political issue.
Right. And then one of the riders who was going in the opposite direction played some role in looking for Lentz?
Right. Well,
which is kind of interesting.
Yes. Well, those two cyclists, the other two, Allen and Sockleben, so they didn't meet Frank Lentz in Shanghai, but they came back to the United States in 93, finished up their ride in June of that year, and then they were, you know, really quite the celebrities. And Sockleben returned to his native St. Louis and opened a bicycle shop.
Really?
Yeah. And it had showers, which was, I think, very, for commuters, far thinking on his part.
I would say so. He would be the hero today.
Well, I've actually proposed. I just read that they're opening in downtown St. Louis a bicycle commuter facility. And I've contacted the organizers, and I've suggested that maybe it'd be nice to honor Sockleben for being so far-sighted with the showers, at least.
What a great idea.
But we'll see where that goes. At any rate, so he's back home in St. Louis in 93, and just kind of, you know, he's just gone around the world. He's been living on the edge, and he was getting kind of restless back home. So shortly thereafter, when it was clear, you know, in the fall of 94, it's clear that something terribly wrong has happened. It's gone wrong with Frank. There was kind of a movement building to send Sokolov, because it seemed to a lot of people he was the best guy to go over there. I mean, he'd
already been once.
He had been there. He'd cycled in that same region. He loved adventure. So, in fact, he was eventually hired by Outing to go over there to find Lenz.
And he never found it.
No, but he did investigate under very difficult circumstances, because by the time he got there in early 1895, Turkey was in complete turmoil.
Right.
There were really waves of massacres, and he even witnessed one while residing in a missionary house and took photos of a mass burial afterwards. There's one in the book. And so, of course, he's impeded under these circumstances. Mm-hmm. And also by the Ottoman government was not cooperative, and even our own government was kind of lackluster in helping him. So he was impeded, but he did come up with a very detailed account of what he believed happened, which I go over in the book. So,
well, we're not going to give any more of that away. So I really appreciate you taking the time this evening. I know it's been a long day for you, and you're headed out. Where are you going next?
On the tour?
Yeah.
I am going to Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to us. David Hurley, The Lost Cyclist. It is by Houghton Mifflin, and you can get a copy right at Joseph Beth, which is where we're sitting. They were nice enough to host a talk this evening. So I wish you a lot of luck.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll talk to you with your next book.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it.
Well, I hope people enjoyed that interview with David V. Hurley. He was just a fascinating gentleman, and it was nice meeting him when he was here in town. And now Joseph Beth is closed, so it's sort of, you know.
Yeah, but his book is still available,
sure.
And he had a great story and great subject matter. So
yes.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Intriguing story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we hope you are enjoying your Thanksgiving holiday with family and friends. And let's see, today was Small Business Saturday. So,
yes!
So hopefully, if you did some shopping, hopefully some of that money you spent was at a small business, because they can use all the help they can get in these times.
Yes.
And we will be back with a fresh, brand new first part of December show next Saturday.
That's right. It will be December.
Yeah, and the holidays are fast approaching. So.
Right.
Anyway, hopefully you've still got some decent weather, or you've dragged the rollers out of storage and you are keeping fit over the winter.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.